From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. After 7 years, hundreds of billions of dollars, an unknown number of Iraqi deaths, nearly 35,000 U.S. injured and 4,400 U.S. dead, President Obama announced this week that U.S. combat operations in Iraq are over.
Tonight, I am announcing that the American combat mission in Iraq has ended. Operation Iraqi Freedom is over, and the Iraqi people now have lead responsibility for the security of their country.
That was his address Tuesday night from the Oval Office, and as one would expect, the Wednesday papers led with the story. But by Thursday, the situation in Iraq had moved back to A4 in the New York Times and A8 in the Washington Post. From cable news, it had vanished altogether. The U.S. combat role in one of the longest, most contentious wars in American history has apparently ended, as T.S. Eliot phrased it, not with a bang, but a whimper. This creep towards the back of the paper, we suspect, will progress as hurricanes, oil rig fires, and celebrity arrests make Obama's announcement old news. But if this coverage constitutes the first draft of history, we wondered, what effect will it have on subsequent drafts? Douglas Brinkley is a professor of history at Rice University, and he joins us once again. Hey, Doug, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you very much.
So, VJ Day, it wasn't. A little understated, the coverage?
Understated, to put it mildly. It was just like a blip on the radar screen. There was a speech by President Obama, prime time from the Oval Office, but the speech was combined with other things, including an economic report card, which diluted the importance of the moment. Perhaps because we're in an economic recession, perhaps because we are so mired in Afghanistan and people want to forget memories of the Iraqi war, it seems to have been kind of swept under the rug and not covered properly, or at least in the way one would have thought so a few years ago.
Compare to me, please, the coverage of the end of this war with every previous war in which this country has engaged.
Well, if we pick up with World War II, with VE Day and then VJ Day, the whole world was involved with it. And also the country, you know, the saying during World War II was, we're all in this together. The Iraq war always felt like it was a divided war, you know, half the country for it, half against it, eventually less than half the country for it. And it seemed to people like a war of choice. We've had other wars of choice in American history. The Mexican-American War was Mr. Polk's war. And the Spanish-American War, you know, Mr. McKinley's war. If it's a war of choice and you want a victory parade, you have to win them quickly. Polk won his war in 4 years, McKinley in 6 months. But when we have protracted wars, people tend to be less celebratory about it. And something like Vietnam, which was a war of choice, in that case, it was big news getting out of Vietnam, but it was more of an embarrassment of watching people clinging to helicopters as they were leaving the roof in Saigon.
There has been some criticism that the coverage of the U.S. exit from combat operations in Iraq was as lacking in skepticism from the press about the government's assertions as was the original invasion itself 7.5 years ago. Did you find that the coverage was gullible in any way?
I was very surprised there wasn't a lot more intense media scrutiny of what's happening in Iraq and what does this mean? We haven't really had the national dialogue. Was this worth it? I think most analysts feel it wasn't worth it. But there's a revisionism seeping in. President Bush has a memoir coming out this fall. Tony Blair has just released one. You're starting to get the Bush people trying to claim victory due to the second Iraqi strategy, which was the surge. And we'll have to see how this all shakes out in history in the end. If a civil society develops there, there's going to be an argument being built by conservatives that this was worth it. It was a battle that had to be fought on the war on terror. If it's anarchy in Baghdad, it'll be seen as the biggest boondoggle in American history. And so we're in a kind of middle zone right now, and people are afraid to make too strong of analysis for fear of being wrong the following week. Now, the Obama administration could have made big drum rolls about the extrication for Iraq, But I strongly believe in 2012, when Obama seeks re-election, he's going to be talking about promises fulfilled. Health care, and I got out of Iraq. Those were my two big issues I ran on, and I lived up to them. It's just being done quietly, because he didn't want a mission accomplished moment, and he certainly doesn't want to call victory there and then have a car bomb go off the next morning.
Doug, as always, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Douglas Brinkley is a professor at Rice University and author most recently of The Wilderness Warrior, Theodore Roosevelt and the Crusade for America. As the majority of the U.S. troops leave Iraq, so too will most of the U.S. journalists. But the people the foreign journalists have depended on for the past 7 years will remain, the Iraqi fixers. Fixers are the local feet on the ground for foreign journalists. They know the language, the culture, and often where to go for the story, and where not to go to stay alive. Many have left Iraq for fear that their work with Western media has made them targets, but some remain. Among them, Hossam al-Massawi, who's worked for the San Francisco Chronicle, the New York Times, McClatchy, Newsweek, and Der Spiegel. He says foreign journalists are closing up shop, leaving him and his colleagues high and dry.
I would say, unfortunately, there are no too much job opportunities here in Iraq, which means we try to find a new beginning.
A new beginning in Iraq or a new beginning elsewhere?
I'm planning to start a new life in the United States because I applied for the International Organization of Migration, but it is now exactly 2 years and I am still here in Iraq. So I started from being optimistic to leave the country and start a new life elsewhere. And now I expect that I am going to spend maybe the rest of my life here in Iraq.
Having worked with the Western press, are you a target for insurgents?
Well, normal people in Iraq are not safe. But it's more dangerous for the people who have been working with media. I always leave the house in the morning, and I expect I'm not going to see my family again. So I always keep saying goodbye to my family in the morning.
Have you been threatened?
Yes, many times. It was in 2004 when I was in an Islamic court in Sadr City because I was accused to be a spy because I was seen with some journalists on TV. We were covering the releasing of some detainees in an American camp in Amriya in Baghdad. So the Mahdi Army group thought that I am working with the American army. They wanted to execute me, but in that mosque, I saw a friend who told the Mahdi army people that I am certainly working for media only and not American media. He told them I am working for the German media, and this really helped me a lot. Otherwise, I would have been killed.
You have worked for many news organizations in the United States and in Europe. Has any of those organizations tried to assist you? I guess what I'm asking you is, are you feeling abandoned right now?
Absolutely. I'm really abandoned. What they could do is just write me a letter that I could introduce to the International Organization of Migration, just to confirm that I worked for American media. I applied for the program since August 2008, but it is now 2 years and I'm still in Iraq. And I expect that I would be seen by the insurgents and maybe they target me. So to be honest in answering your question, yes, I am left, I am abandoned, and I am not secure. And nobody is protecting me. I am protecting myself. The security companies just protect us when we do some work with the foreign journalists when they are here in Baghdad. Otherwise, we do most of the reporting by ourselves without any protection.
How old are you, Hassam?
I am 34 years old.
Are you married? Do you have children?
No. I live with my sisters here in Baghdad. I prefer not to get married because if I am killed, I'm going to leave my wife or my kids without any source of getting living. It's really very tough to have my own family.
In the end, was it worth it?
Well, I would say yes and no. Yes, because I learned a lot of new things I would have not learned if I have not worked for foreign media. After the war, I am able to provide my family with good food. I am able to buy a generator every year so we can get electricity. But now I feel it didn't worth. And if things deteriorate, I would say it never worth to work for the foreign media. To be an ordinary person who die in an accident is normal. But to sleep your night afraid of the future, to drive your car and keep looking in the mirror to see if you are followed or not, to go into a store and to be afraid that there would be somebody who recognizes you as somebody who worked for the foreign media, it didn't work.
Hassam, I thank you, and I wish you all the best of luck and health and a long life for yourself and your family.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Hassam Al-Massawi has been a fixer for the San Francisco Chronicle, New York Times, McClatchy, Newsweek, and Der Spiegel.
Coming up, Middle East Peace Talks Deja Vu and the Crowd Counting Conundrum.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. And I'm here to reassure you, it's not just you.
Israeli and Palestinian leaders return to Washington once again in search of common ground.
It's taken months of pushing by Washington to get these two sides back together.
No president has been able to resolve thorny issues like how to divide Jerusalem, claimed by both sides as their capital. Millions of Palestinian refugees demanding the right of return. Israeli settlements and final borders between Israel.
I'm guessing a lot of us, as we've consumed this week's coverage of the peace talks that began Wednesday in Washington between Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, are experiencing a certain sense of déjà vu. For at least the last 15 years, reporting on the peace talks between Israel and Palestine has followed a familiar template, as characterizations, metaphors, and verb phrases are recycled every time talks are resuscitated or pulled back from the brink or put on life support or, well, you get the idea. Put this all together, and any reader could be forgiven for thinking it would probably be just fine to skip over the latest installment of this never-ending story. J.J. Goldberg, senior columnist for the Jewish weekly newspaper The Forward, has covered Palestine and Israel for years, and he maintains that this round of talks is worthy of your attention. It's a rich picture, though he concedes that bringing new perspectives to peace talks is easier said than done.
It's almost like one of these word games where you slip in. It's like Mad Libs. The hardline Israeli leader, the Palestinian movement, which is fighting for Palestinian statehood. Because we're in a hurry and because we don't have much room, we fit in the templates and they lull us to sleep. It looks like the same story. And if there's an element that's different, you could miss it. It could be left out. Frequently, the reporter will find something that looks so different that they want to go with it, and the editor says, that sounds bizarre. I don't want that there because it doesn't sound right.
So let's unpack some of those. There seems to be a general trope in the American press that Israel tends to be portrayed as intransigent. The Palestinian leadership tends to be portrayed as corrupt or incompetent. Do you think that's a fair evocation of the kind of characterizations we've seen over a decade and a half or two?
You do see that. And frequently, the public story that the leaders put out to their own public is more extreme than what they're actually aiming for. Occasionally, an Ariel Sharon will come forward and show you a face that you never saw. He didn't go through some magical transformation. He had been a pragmatist all along, although his tactics were extremely brutal. His strategic goals were more pragmatic. So when he said, okay, we're pulling out.
Pulling out of Gaza.
Yes. People were shocked because that side of him had been ignored. Netanyahu, what gets ignored, is he's pliable. Some people refer to him as one of these vinyl sofas. He looks like the last person who sat on him. Mahmoud Abbas is portrayed as weak, unstable. He could fall any minute. The guy has been number two or number one in Fatah since the 60s. That's not a weak person. That's a person who knows how to survive.
Which brings us to some of the more durable metaphors of this entire peace process. Verbs like reviving, drowning, last breath of the peace process. One great description we found was, it's a roller coaster where the cars are secured to the track, but they go up and down and up and down. Do you see progress here, or are the media right to characterize this as a perpetual roller coaster?
I would say the common belief in the region is that it can't be perpetual because the prospect of a peaceful two-state solution is running out of time.
That's another constant trope over the last 15 years. Now or never, against the odds, the stakes have never been higher, and so forth.
It's a little bit like global warming. They put it off sometime in the middle of this century or the beginning of the 22nd century. We're going to see heats rise and bizarre weather, and now it's 2010, and we're seeing it already. Time was running out. Boom, it ran out. And that's approaching in Israel and Palestine in hard numbers in the demographics of it.
So this time has really run out.
Within 20 years at most, I would say, in the area now under Israeli control. If there isn't a partition into two states, Jews will be a minority, and it will either be a binational state and the end of Zionism, or an apartheid state and the end of democracy. So that there is no time left to reach this agreement. From the Palestinian point of view, they want a separate state, the majority, because it will be another 100 years of violence, even if they do become the majority, before they achieve a single unitary Palestinian state.
Why?
The assumption is that Israelis will fight. There's a growing percentage of the Israeli population, and a rapidly growing percentage, that is extremely religious, that is messianic about the land. And a growing percentage of the army, of the officer corps, is made up of settlers and their allies. This concerns the general staff. They're worried. There was a secret report out 2 years ago. What happens when the army becomes a tool that will no longer agree to enforce an evacuation? There's one more thing we overlook. The Palestinians have been going through a gradual process of moderation since 1974. Because each step, such as setting up a Palestinian state temporarily on areas liberated, such as opening a diplomatic front alongside the armed struggle, each one has been dismissed by the Israeli side as being a meaningless change. We didn't notice the evolution toward acceptance of Israel.
It often feels like a reader could sit out a couple of rounds of peace talks over the course of a decade, dip in again, like a soap opera when the characters never develop or change.
That's a temptation, and perhaps this whole phenomenon of media saturation has reached us all where we can't take it anymore. We didn't focus on the changes in the climate and the environment, and now we're surprised that disasters are already happening. We haven't paid enough attention to the tectonic changes under the surface in the Middle East conflict, so now it's hard to see this as different from all the others. The actions look the same, but the scenery and the stage have changed so much that the outcome could be different.
If there was one thing that you could change about the pattern of narrative for these peace talk stories year after year after year, what would it be?
I suppose first I would have every story accompanied by a box with a timeline that shows different stages of negotiation and how they differed from each other. Perhaps a graph that shows how the two sides have moved over the last 20 years.
They've moved?
Well, the Palestinians in 1970 were saying no recognition, no peace, no coexistence, and now they're saying we want statehood. The Israelis in 67 said we're holding the territories, we will trade them in return for peace. Now they're saying we're entitled to a share of this, or to all of it. there are profound changes that have happened in the last 10 years, and there's no time to tell them all. The Arab League initiative that would recognize Israel in return for Palestinian statehood. The rise of Iran, which gives the Sunni Arab states, the close states, a sense of common cause with Israel. Let's make this thing go away so that we can work together against the Iranian Shiite threat. These things are changes. So there is an evolution. There are straight lines that travel. Well, they're bumpy lines. They are like a roller coaster, but they get somewhere.
So with that graph, we wouldn't fall into the pattern of thinking it is always as it ever was and ever shall be.
That's exactly right. If we could see the past, not in a long story, the sort that I like to tell, but in charts and graphs, then you can see how does this fit into it. There's also the question of when the sides state their positions, what do they really think? People here don't know because it's not said in English how dovish the Israeli military is, how much they think Israel would be better off without the territories. They don't know that. The narrative is, oh, the Israeli army, they're pushing Israel. The same thing with the Palestinians. People haven't realized how strongly the pressure has been in Fatah for an agreement with Israel for the past 20 years, 20-something years.
So another revolutionary change in reporting the story might be simply to translate.
One would be to translate. A second one would be to get away from the idea that an alternative view is somebody in Birkenstocks who's calling for peace. The alternative in Israel is not the peace movement or people with placards. It's the military versus the political. The alternative in the Arab world isn't necessarily Islamism versus secular revolution, but pragmatism, middle-class desire for peace, families, on both sides. We don't see that. We hear the politicians yelling at their people and trying to get reelected.
JJ, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
J.J. Goldberg is the senior columnist for the weekly newspaper The Forward and its website, The Jewish Daily Forward. Sometimes it's hard to know who to trust, especially when it comes to numbers.
I have just gotten word from the media that there is over 1,000 people here today.
On August 28th, from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, Glenn Beck tweaked the press as he surveyed the crowd attending his Restoring Honor rally because he knew the truth, as he said later.
We'll have aerial photography here shortly on the numbers, but I can tell you that it was in the hundreds of thousands. Let's be on the low end, 300,000. It may be as high as 650,000.
But Minnesota Republican Michelle Bachmann at her own post-Beck rally disagreed.
We're not going to let anybody get away with telling us there were fewer than a million people because we were here. We are witnesses.
Crowd estimates flew overhead like the geese over the rally. ABC News went with 100,000 plus, NBC News with some 300,000, and NPR with tens of thousands. Meanwhile, CBS News actually paid for some research and arrived at a figure between 80 and 90,000. Stephen Doig helped calculate it by using aerial photos.
People way overestimate how many people can be packed into a given area using like 2 square feet per person. That is, you know, scary, mosh pit, dangerous kind of density. People couldn't fall over if they fainted.
Doig says Washington is a tough town for crowd counters to get an angle on.
There aren't very many tall buildings. I think there's a municipal ordinance that doesn't allow anything over just a very few stories. The highest thing in D.C., to my knowledge, is the Washington Monument. But it was useless for crowd counting because the angle was too oblique. It wasn't overhead enough. So CBS went to a company called Air Photos Live, which uses tethered balloons with cameras on them to get really beautiful, detailed overhead images. And then I used their images to make my honest estimates of the density of the crowds in different parts of that whole sprawling area that it was in. It's actually fairly low-tech science.
You estimated about 80,000, and the other expert that CBS hired estimated about 87,000. They went with 87,000. You said, you know, same difference.
Absolutely. I would never swear that exactly 80,000 people were there. Actually, I had one commenter on my blog about this who sent me a note saying, well, there had to be at least 100 people in porta potties at the time of the image. And I said, okay, my estimate now is 80,100.
As for that 300,000 NBC number, that was provided by an NBC News staffer, Domenico Montanaro, who tweeted last Saturday that that's what an unnamed Park Service official said. NBC's Brian Williams.
At Glenn Beck's rally on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial yesterday, he was able to attract a crowd. I've seen estimates 500,000. NBC News estimated the crowd at 300,000.
And what did the New York Times do?
They quoted NBC, which is really the chicken way out. NBC is not a source. And usually there is a way to at least produce a number that can be sort of grounded at least in reality. And that's really what the science of statistics is for.
Science schmience. Doig was roundly condemned by the right for lowballing Beck's rally.
Well, obviously, I must be a liberal dupe who was paid to underestimate it. And of course, others on the other side of the ideological stream said, oh, yes, you know, obviously you're doing very scientific methods, and clearly that's very good. That really amuses me because 18 months or 20 months ago, I did the Obama estimate. I came up with a number of around 800,000 being there on the mall for the inauguration. That number was lower than the pre-event predictions, some of which were laughably high, like 5 million. So my prediction then became embraced by those who didn't really want to see Obama draw a big crowd and was sort of ignored by the supporters. So exactly the same methods produced exactly the opposite reaction from the different ends of the political stream.
Carl Holmberg, who retired from the U.S. Park Police in 2000 after 35 years on the job, assisted the Washington Post's Dan Keating in his calculation of attendance at Obama's inauguration. Using aerial photography, they came up with a range of 1 to 1.2 million. But after an earlier Post story tossed out 1.8 million, that's the number that stuck. Carl Holmberg.
And I'm not exactly sure where that 1.8 number came from. Somebody came out with a figure. There was no protocols applied. There is no procedure explained. And I would just hope that our history would be written a little more accurately than just based on an unnamed source.
I like data. I like facts rather than just numbers that people throw around based on their opinion.
Washington Post database editor Dan Keating, who learned his methods from Stephen Doig when they were at the Miami Herald, saw his own science-based estimate of 1 million overshadowed in his own paper by that more memorable figure of 1.8. So how did the Post report attendance at Beck's rally last week?
I believe we've made reference to Glenn Beck's number. I believe we've made reference to Michelle Bachmann's million number. And I believe we may have made reference to the number that CBS derived.
But if they just gave each of those three numbers equal weight, that's a problem. Wouldn't the normal reader see one as the low estimate, one as the high estimate, and maybe wind up with Glenn Beck's number as the right one? And isn't that, given that there was no science behind Glenn Beck's number, foisting a misrepresentation upon the public in order to appear fair?
Well, I think it's hard to completely ignore what people say. We put it in the best possible context we can. We'll go to a lot of effort to put some science behind a number. And then it kind of goes up into the media atmosphere and gets sucked up in with every other number that people just whip off the top of their head. And I wish there was an easy way of saying, you know, hey, my number is better than all your numbers. But the number that we worked really hard to put a lot of facts behind sometimes loses its weight as compared to all the other numbers bandied about.
So the solution would be an official number. And in fact, the Park Police still uses aerial photographs and density calculations to estimate crowds for planning purposes. But it can't release those numbers, not since the mother of all crowd estimate disputes erupted into the threat of a lawsuit in 1995.
1 million sober, disciplined, committed, dedicated, inspired black men.
Long live the spirit of the Million Man March!
Long live the spirit of the Million Man March!
Well, the name was attached to it 6 months prior to the event.
Retired Park Service estimator Carl Holmberg.
And when you call it the Million Man March, I guess you expect to have 1 million people there, but our count didn't go up to 1 million people.
What was your count?
I believe it was like 250,000.
So when you come up with a quarter of the advertised amount, what happens?
People get upset. The sponsors do, anyway. And the Million Man March certainly is not the only one. We had others that wanted to take us to court. Certainly many anti-war rallies thought that we had shortchanged them. And so Congress, in I believe it was our 1997 appropriations bill, directed the Park Police to stop estimating crowds.
You wish that Congress would once again reauthorize the Park Police to reissue those numbers?
Well, if they want accurate numbers, or as accurate a number as they can get, then they should. If they're happy with just having everybody name their own number, then I guess that's up to Congress.
So, there you have it, folks. Just another of many inconvenient truths. The difference here is that this one has been neatly legislated out of existence.
Coming up, the anatomy of a deceitful tweet and the lie that transformed the newspaper industry.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 800-555-TREE. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last week, Washington Post sports writer and D.C. sports radio host Mike Wise sent out a tweet about NFL quarterback Ben Roethlisberger. The Pittsburgh Steelers star had been suspended in April for 6 games because of conduct off the field, including allegations of sexual assault. Rumors had been circulating that the league would reduce his suspension to 4 games, which could profoundly affect the Steelers' prospects for the coming football season. What Wise tweeted, though, before those rumors actually came to fruition, was that the suspension would be revised to 5 games. Many news outlets, including the Miami Herald, the Baltimore Sun, and the NBC sports blog Pro Football Talk, ran the tweet. The only problem was, Wise had invented the story. As a stunt for his radio show, he wanted to demonstrate that even a pure fabrication would be picked up without verification by online media. Well, he was right about that. He also succeeded in making us think about the symbiosis of old and new media, the notion that the parasite may be slowly killing the host it needs in order to survive. Oh, and one more thing Mike Wise accomplished. He managed to get suspended for a month by the Washington Post, which took a dim view of its staffers manufacturing outright lies. A bizarre episode, to say the least, a kind of morality tale about trust. One man who trusted too much was Mike Florio, editor of the blog Pro Football Talk, who ran Wise's fake scoop on the front page of his blog. He says that the only thing this fiasco proved was that Mike Wise abused the credibility of the Washington Post.
I did have misgivings because it went against the grain, but it's a report from a man, a respected journalist, with a newspaper that has a national name. And the fact that it did go against the grain made it a noteworthy and interesting and presumably reliable story to disseminate to my readers and for other media to disseminate to their readers as well.
Do you think there should be a different standard for accuracy and sourcing for something that a reporter tweets as opposed to what they have set in type in their newspaper?
Well, I think first and foremost, the standard of what a person puts on his or her Twitter page should be governed by the standards already promulgated by the newspaper or other media company for which he or she works. And specifically in this case, the Washington Post company had already made it clear that that's the standard they expect Mike Wise and the other journalists at the newspaper to follow.
What kind of point was he trying to make?
The point was anybody will go with anything that's posted on Twitter. He should have set up a dummy account, put things up there under this assumed name for a period of time to see if he ever could gain traction just by making things up and see whether or not other reporters would take that as the starting point for their own reporting. But he used the reputation of his employer to float a false story. That's not the way to prove the point that he was trying to make. He has no understanding whatsoever of how this new media world operates.
Still in all, his invented scoop was picked up by people like you with no attempt to verify it. And presumably, his point was that, therefore, we can assume that many other weakly sourced or completely invented rumors and misinformation are also aggregated by blogs like yours.
But let me ask you this. If Mike Wise had made that assertion in an item printed in the Washington Post and delivered to your doorstep, what should anyone have done to verify what he said in there? Should he have been called up to say, is this a hoax? Are you trying to prove a broader social point here? Or could that be relied upon as something that could be passed along to someone else, not as the gospel truth, but as Mike Wise of the Washington Post reports, Ben Roethlisberger will be suspended 5 games?
You know, in business, there's something called a net promoter score. It's a measure of customer service and consumer trust, actually. Do you think as a result of what Mike Wise did, your net promoter score has gone down?
I don't think so, because I don't know what I could have done differently that would have been reasonable. If I call up Mike Wise to say to him, is this a hoax? Has your Twitter account been hacked? When you say Roethlisberger, are you referring to Ben Roethlisberger and not Fred Roethlisberger from Topeka, Kansas?
All right.
If I do that, then how am I ever going to get any work done? If Adam Schefter of ESPN reports on Twitter that someone's signing a new contract, I should be entitled to take that to the bank. The reader should be entitled to take that to the bank. Not that it's ultimately accurate, because reporters get things wrong, but that it's at least an attempt to be accurate. I think in Mike Wise's effort to make some broader statement, what he essentially did was try to throw a wrench into the gears of the new media that he apparently despises because he doesn't understand it. And he proved his failure to understand it by trying to make his point in a way that ultimately hurt one person, Mike Wise, and one media company, The Washington Post.
Yeah. Mike, thank you so much.
Well, hey, great talking to you. Interesting discussion. And I'm sure there'll be more issues like this coming up in the future.
Mike Florio is the editor of the Pro Football Talk blog on NBCSports.com. For his part, Mike Wise says he was just trying to prove a point about the lack of journalistic ethics in today's world of instant publishing. He joins us now. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Bob.
Please note that the words to follow technically form a question.
Okay.
What a stupid stunt, eh?
Should I answer that?
Yeah, please.
Okay, the answer to that question was, boy, you did your homework today. You did it well.
Why did you send out the bogus tweet? What was the point?
The original idea was I was doing a radio show bit. I've been doing it for about a year, and I sort of preached journalism credibility. I would have Bob Schieffer on to talk about journalism ethics, and I would be incensed at all these erroneous reports that nobody ever paid the price for. And so in my harebrained thinking, I would throw out a tweet about Ben Roethlisberger's suspension and say, it was 5 games, I'm told. And I did it during the radio show. And I told people on the radio show, I will correct it in 2 to 3 minutes, and you will see afterward how ridiculous our media news cycle is nowadays. No one will vet this story. No one will source it. And in the absent-mindedness of my radio show, I hit the follow tweet, which was something to the effect that I was kidding. And I looked at my Twitter account about 40 minutes later, and it said, Twitter over capacity. It never went through. So a good hour had lapsed before I actually made it clear that this was a joke. And the bottom line is, that was a Washington Post Twitter account. If I had not had a job at the Washington Post and the radio show was it, no one would say anything.
So among the things you learned from this fiasco was that the Washington Post doesn't really want to have Opie and Anthony sending out fake tweets. And your hoax was trading on the credibility of the Washington Post.
Yeah. When you start this out and you think to yourself, boy, maybe I could be Woodward and Bernstein one day. And all of a sudden you wake up one day and you're halfway to Howard Stern. You realize something didn't click into my brain at that moment, that I was a Post employee and they would take this seriously. And this wouldn't just be a joke. You know, I didn't wake up that day thinking I needed to detonate my career, but somewhere in the neural pathways of my warped brain that day, I thought this was a radio bit.
Your plan was to unmask the world of bloggers and aggregators who will repost anything without a moment's effort to check facts, sources, and so on. I guess you have succeeded in that, huh?
Yes and no. I mean, there's 10 ways to do that, and I picked the absolute worst way.
But if the reader comes to this thing knowing that he or she is getting just the latest dump of rumors that have been harvested from here, there, and everywhere, doesn't the reader bring with him or her, you know, a certain amount of skepticism and caveat emptor in what is being linked to?
If this trust in the media and trust in what you read and you hear and you watch is constantly being eroded, in my mind, there has to be a breaking point. And the only way to do this is hold people that didn't do their homework accountable. And until that's done, we are going to continue to lose circulation, listeners, and believers. One of the blogs in question that made a homepage out of the story, this is the same blog that revealed that Terry Bradshaw had died several years ago. And this person had to print a retraction for his blog and say that actually someone died on the Terry Bradshaw freeway in Louisiana. It actually didn't happen. And I think it's worrisome, and I think it's scary, and I think there's just too much of it going around. If that's considered aggregate news and that you can hide behind, I don't have any classical journalism training, that's pretty sad where we're at.
Are we talking about Mike Florio and ProFootballTalk.com?
Yes.
Now, by a quirk of radio production timing, we spoke to Mike Florio before we got a chance to talk to you. But based on what I've learned from the two of you, it almost looks like the substance of this is more like a blood feud than anything that has to do with journalistic values. Have I just blundered into the Hatfields and the McCoys?
Well, I don't dislike Mike Florio. I dislike the idea of Mike Florio. I dislike the idea of someone hiding behind the idea that I don't have classical journalism training, so my job is to put news out there irrespective of whether it's wrong or not. He said in an interview recently that speed is so important in his business, therefore if he's the first one to get it up, his credibility goes up. I can't imagine that speed is more important than accuracy, but in that milieu it is. And I will say this, most people in my profession that wrote me, some of which agreed with my point, nobody agreed with what I did. That said, there was a personal note of, hey, hang in there. This was one moment of lapse. And it's sad, but there's a chunk of my credibility gone today. And I need to build that back up. The 20 years that nobody had ever questioned that, now it has been, and I promise it won't happen again. Not necessarily Mike Florio, but what some people of his ilk and some people of his job description can't say is that it won't happen again.
All right, Mike. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob, for taking the time to hear me out.
Mike Wise is a sports writer for The Washington Post, or at least he will be again just about the beginning part of October.
Are you shocked, shocked about journalists inventing stories to prove a point? The practice goes way back. An example of particular significance to the news industry occurred at the end of another very hot summer in 1835, when a New York tabloid published a series of articles under the headline Great Astronomical Discoveries about an astronomer who glimpsed life most fantastical on the moon. It was widely believed. This most successful hoax in American journalism was penned by British expat Richard Adams Locke, editor of the New York Sun. The brainchild of the publisher Benjamin Day, the Sun was the earliest of the so-called penny papers, papers that pitched themselves to a working-class audience who plucked from the newsstands stories of crime and corruption, news about their communities, sports, and scandal. Before the penny papers, daily papers cost 6 cents and were directed towards well-heeled subscribers who cared more about world markets than local affairs. The penny papers democratized the news. But this also was an era of scoundrels and hucksters and provocateurs like Sun editor Richard Adams Locke, who wrote his saga of moon creatures as a satire, never imagining it would make the Sun the Earth's most successful paper.
The conventional wisdom among astronomers of the time was that the moon was in fact inhabited. And not just the moon, but all the planets, all the stars, comets, even the sun. because God would not have created these celestial bodies without also creating intelligent beings there to appreciate them. He believed that religion had no place in scientific inquiry, and so he decided to write this series of stories that pretended to discover crazy beings on the moon. But what he hadn't anticipated was that the public had been so schooled in the theories of these religious astronomers that when the stories were published, they simply believed them. But in point of fact, they were intended as a satire of the religious astronomers of the day.
Intended as a satire by Richard Adams Locke, but not necessarily by the New York Sun, which never disowned its own hoax. And we're talking about, in the paper, a series of reports of unicorns, beavers that walked on their hind legs.
That's right.
4-foot-tall man bats.
The lunar man bats. They were the crowning touch of the series, the Vespertilio Homo. They were supposed to have been dubbed by the astronomers that talked and flew and built temples and fornicated in public, according to The Sun, which caused a great sensation. But Richard Adams Locke was the editor of The Sun. He wasn't the publisher of The Sun. The publisher of The Sun, Benjamin Day, was quite pleased to have this story believed. And then The Sun, of course, discovered that they could make even more money by putting out commodities related to the series. So they published the series as a pamphlet and sold that on the street. They put out a lithograph of the supposed landscape of the moon with the unicorns and the man bat. So The Sun ended up making tens of thousands of dollars as a result of this hoax.
And never itself exposed it.
It was eventually revealed by another newspaper that Locke was indeed the author of the hoax. Locke, one drunken evening, admitted to a colleague on a rival paper that he was, in fact, the author of the hoax. But The Sun themselves never did own up to hoaxing the public, and the public never turned away from The Sun in the aftermath of this. You know, their circulation numbers never went back down. People just kind of tipped their hat to the hoaxer and said, job well done, and next time we won't be quite so gullible. And in the wake of this hoax, more penny papers began to be published once they saw how successful penny papers could be. And within the next 10 years or so, you saw hundreds of penny papers developing throughout the United States. This was really the moment, the late 1830s, 1840s, 1850s, when America became for the first time a nation of newspaper readers.
Are you experiencing a sense of deja vu, this movement
Yes.
launched by the penny papers, this fight between various versions of reality, a de-emphasis on what may be factually true?
Well, that's exactly right. There is in some way an analogy to what is going on today with the seeming death of old-line print journalism being replaced by the Internet. The Internet is at least as much a transmitter of hoaxes as it is a potential debunker of them. You know, the fact that on the eve of the election, 25% of the electorate of the state of Texas believe that President Obama is a Muslim is a hoax.
I think we've returned to a period, perhaps, when we just don't care.
The success of these hoaxes is that they tend to confirm what people would like to believe anyway. People chose to believe that there were inhabitants on the moon because it made them believe that there was, in fact, this idea of a benevolent God who was creating intelligent beings everywhere, and we were not alone in the universe. I think today people are prone to want to believe that Barack Obama is a Muslim because of pre-existing ideas that they have, and I think that the Internet is simply just as good a means of helping people to confirm their prejudices as any that we've had in the past.
Matthew, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you very much, Brooke. I appreciate it.
Matthew Goodman is an author of The Sun and the Moon, the remarkable true account of hoaxers, showmen, dueling journalists, and lunar man-bats in 19th century New York.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and Alex Goldman, with more help from Brett Jaspers, Bonnie Watt, and Nerida Brownlee, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from John Delore. This week, we bid goodbye to Michael Chaplin. Thanks for your hard work, Michael. Good luck to you.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and WNYC's senior director for national productions, Ellen Horn, officially has our back. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. You can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.